to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Why don't we have anybody from the public who would like to make a comment at our informal meeting, make their comment now? Hearing none. Let's move forward with the agenda even though we can't adopt it. How's that?
Well, since there's no action to be taken, I recommend you just go right to report discussion action and start receiving the reports.
My pleasure. Is that all right with you guys? Let's see, which is the first? We're now on what on your paper is item number six. And the accreditation report. It's all done and you've completed everything.
That was my Christmas wish. Santa didn't deliver. Good morning. My name is Mimi Gia. I'm the Performance and Quality Improvement Coordinator / Accreditation Coordinator. We have been working on the accreditation since, I believe, the documentation was submitted in January of 2018, but it was in 2017, 2018, this agency has spent quite a bit of effort trying to get this agency accredited. Since January of 2019, I have taken over the accreditation coordinator role. And since then, I established structure where we have 12 domains, and each domain is led by domain leads. I'm not the subject matter expert when it comes to each domain. These are core public health functions, and these domain leaders are subject matter experts. So they are, in essence, I've worked with them to create the action plan, and they are implementing the action plan. We have 159 items on the action plan, and slowly but steadily, we are implementing each one of those action plans. I have to say, because our documentation was submitted back in January of 2018, site visit took place a year ago in January of 2019, we can actually go back to use any kind of documentation that we have created since January of 2018. So we already have done quite a bit of work towards the action plan, to fulfilling action plan. And you have asked specifically what the advisory board could do. The accreditation recommends that we have close relationship with governing entity. And what they mean by that is we need to be in communication with you regarding our performance and particularly quality improvement activities. So having you listen to our quality improvement project, like it's coming up on next, that is what we are asking advisory board to be involved in, and that's what the accreditation recommends. So to have you know what's going on and how we are improving our operations through quality improvement, that is what the accreditation recommends. And you have given us specific items.
I made the mistake of reading your report.
You know,
and I went through it and I thought, those little sections might be ones in which we can help you, but I didn't know for sure.
I so appreciate that. I think you're the first governing entity member that I went through. So it is much appreciated, and I feel very much indebted to you, and I am very grateful that I have your full support on that matter. So to answer your specifics, 2.3 is about the public health lab, so I don't think you need to be involved in that. And all these items I have conferred with the domain leaders prior to coming here and making report to you. So they are in the galley. And if you,
what I did is I read after our last meeting that long report which you had given, and I went through and checked off possible areas in which we on the board might be able to help them to get moved accreditation on. And I probably picked half of them when appropriate, but who knows?
Excuse me, can I just interrupt for a second? Michael Collins is on the phone, so if we could just take a pause here and step back and approve the adoption of the agenda and the consent agenda.
Why don't I call the meeting to order? And I move that we approve the adoption of the agenda. Do I hear a second? All in favor?
Michael, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thank you.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
What else?
Any opposed?
Any opposed? Hearing none, the agenda is adopted. What else did we forget?
The consent agenda.
I move the adoption of the consent agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Now we're current.
Okay.
Thank you.
So she's now responding to those sections that I wrote down on a piece of scratch paper that probably half of them are inappropriate.
No, we, like I said, we appreciate your involvement. And so I'm just going to go down the list. Okay, 4.1.2, that is a community engagement plan. And right now where we are at is intern has been assigned to it, and she's researching community engagement models. So when it comes to that, we would present it to the advisory board again and then ask for your feedback. Okay, 4.2.2, this one, the action plan has been written so that we need to have a, we need to report to Board of Health or advisory board. On this agenda item, we have chosen to get Board of Health involved. Specifically, we're talking likely that we're going to be using example of fee increase, how the Board of Health was involved in EH food operations fee increase. So that's...
So you don't need us for 4.2?
No.
Okay.
I mean, we could use it. We might change our example, what we're going to be using. In the middle of the way, so in that case, we might come to you again. We cannot say it for definitely, but as of now, I think our example of using Board of Health would be good to fulfill this measure. 5.2.4, this is regarding CHIP, and this is a big one, and how we are moving forward with it is OEDS has hired a new person, Dante, and she here, and she's going to be leading this, and she is
welcome.
So that's where we are at.
And that one has involved us since the beginning.
Yes, so we will be reporting back to you on the CHIP. Like I said, she just started a week ago. Okay, 7.1.2, you are correct that this needed, I'm saying it in past tense, that needed the community involvement. However, this has been done and they involved the community by focus group, using the focus group. So this has been done. It was drafted and finished in May of 2019. 10.2.3, committee was formed. We met once and...
Tell them what that is.
That 10.2.3 is about research dissemination, how we need to disseminate the information to the public. So we have convened a committee to say how we go about it. And we're working on that. Met once, and we will keep meeting. And how you can be involved is we would send you information to you because you're considered a public and also governing entity. 12.3.3, that is about administration and governing entities' involvement and how we present our performance metrics and specifically QI activities. And this, following my report to you, would be a QI presentations. And that's the third one. And this is basically what we are asking for your help. Just being here and listening to us and getting a report, that is the major chunk of this measure. And we already have good two examples so far, and you will get to see the third one and hear about it.
Did I leave any sections off when I went?
I don't think you did.
Keep in mind that people on this board represent large communities and can disseminate information if it's appropriate.
We very much appreciate that. In fact, we will be asking you to disseminate information in one of the presentations that's coming up. That is it from me.
Any questions?
Just one question, thank you very much. I mean, where are we in the entire process in regards to what's the next step from the accreditation board? Is there a particular timeline that you're shooting for?
So, drop dead deadline for all the documentation and action plan to be implemented and documentation be submitted on their documentation repository website. That is September of 2019. I'm sorry, 2020, September 2020. And so we have 9 months. After that, they're going to convene and review the documentation that we have uploaded and let us know. And usually takes about 6 months, I'd say. They meet quarterly, so it takes about 3 months to review the documents, and then 3 months, you know, depends on where that landed on the quarter. It could take up to 6 months to get response back from them.
Thank you.
I have a question. The reason, X number of years ago, the reason for trying to get accreditation is to improve the opportunities to get grants. Can you still apply for grants and say the accreditation is in process? Is that helping?
So I had the opportunity to ask the CEO of FAB, Public Health Accreditation Board, why isn't this tied to the grant? Because that would give us competitive edge. And her response, Kay Binger's response was, because these are the things we should be doing anyway. This is fundamentals. We are not going to tie it to the grant. However, having said that, I come from Utah Department of Health. At the state level, on the grant applications, I've noticed that on CDC grant applications, they would be asking, is your agency accredited? That's one of their application questions. So I don't know if they're putting any weight on that or are they just gathering for the informational purposes? That I don't know. But in my experience, program level people told me that two states that were picked up in a competitive grant from the CDC were accredited agency. Two were dropped were not accredited State Department of Health, so.
So it appears as if we need to complete the process to improve your chances of getting the federal.
I believe so, but CDC or FAB, neither one of them came out officially and said this is the way. I think the reason for that is because they do not want to punish small public health agencies, but that's just my speculation.
Any other questions?
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can read the next.
Yeah. Isn't the next, the STD report?
Yes.
And this was specifically asked by Tina, who was not here, to give us an update. It's hit a lot of press.
Good morning. My name is Angel Stachnik. I am with the Office of Epidemiology and Disease Surveillance. And I am basically here to bombard you with statistics on STDs here. So I'm going to cover three STDs, basically on the surface level with the time permitted. I'll be talking about syphilis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea. All of these three diseases are reportable nationally, along with Clark County as well. So the first slide, I kind of want to jump in. So this is out of CDC, except for the Clark County rate, which compares the primary and secondary syphilis rate in Nevada compared to the US rate in 2018. And as you can see, the US rate was about 11 per 100,000 population. Nevada, much higher at 23. And Clark County is even higher at 25 per 100,000 population. This actually puts Nevada at number one in terms of rates. We were number one last year as well. Number two is actually California, and this year number three is Mississippi. So next we're looking at the infectious syphilis rate for the last 5 years in Clark County. And infectious syphilis rate is a grouping of primary syphilis, secondary syphilis, and early latent, or now it's called early syphilis, non-primary, and non-secondary. As you can see here, we've been increasing both in the female and the male population up until about 2017. And then if you look at the gray line here, it's actually our overall syphilis rate, we've actually starting to plateau. So this is a good sign. We're hoping to continue for 2019 as well. And we should know about this here in about a month or so after all our 2019 cases are finalized. Just looking at the rates over here separated by the age groups, they start off at like a five-year age group, like 15 from 19, 20 to 24, and it goes all the way until we get to about 45, and then it goes 45 to 54 and 55 to 64. I know this slide is pretty busy. We have the largest rate happening in the group of 25 to 29 years old. As you can see, in 2018, there were about 124 per 100,000. And then not too far along is the age group 25 to 29, at almost 122 per 100,000 population.
I have a question.
Yes.
So are these reported rates, are these general rates of people going to their private medical doctor and also public health, or are these just public health rates that are reported, just generally and from Nevada? Mm-hmm.
So this is Clark County, and it's all of the cases that was reported to us. So it does include private providers as well.
So if you go to a private provider, are they mandated to report that to Clark County? Then?
Yes, they are. So just as you can see here, just to get the overall point here, is that we're actually seeing, we've seen compared to what 5 years ago, the rate has increased in pretty much every age group. Now we're just kind of looking at it by race. Here, the blacks actually have the highest rate in 2018, they had 121 per 100,000. But here, rates actually have increased in all age groups. API is Asian Pacific Islanders, and they have the lowest rate here in 2018 at 18.2 per 100,000. And just to give you some additional characteristics of what we found in our infectious syphilis cases. So 55% occurred among men who have sex with other men. 39% were also HIV positive. We found the mean number of partners to be 7, ranging from 0 to 240 partners. 46% reported using drugs. Meth was the most commonly reported choice of drug. 54% engaged in anonymous sex. But if you look at among men who have sex with other men, this increased to 74%. 46% met partners via hookup sites. But again, if we look at it among the men who have sex with other men, this jumped to 81%. And some of the top websites and apps that were reported was Grindr, Adam for Adam, Jacked, Craigslist and Facebook, and Scruff. And majority of these, except for Craigslist and Facebook, are MSM sites. So moving on to congenital syphilis, this is also comparing Clark County in Nevada to the U.S. in 2018. And at the U.S. in 2018, we were at 33. Nevada much higher at almost 86 per 100,000. And then if you look at Clark County, it jumps to almost 105 per 100,000. So just kind of give you an idea in terms of numbers. So in 2018, Nevada reported 31 cases of congenital syphilis. That puts us at number 2. Number 1 is actually Texas. They have about 300 and something cases, but because of the size of our population, we ranked in number 2. Clark County actually accounted for 24 out of those 31 cases in 2018, and just to put it in perspective, in 2014 we had 3 cases. So it's a major jump. Just to give you an idea of what 2019 looks like preliminary, we currently have 35 cases reported. So we have surpassed last year's numbers. So moving on to chlamydia. This is another one where we compare Clark County and Nevada to the U.S. Not much of a difference as you've seen like in syphilis and congenital syphilis, but we're still much higher than the U.S. rate. And actually in Clark County in 2008, we actually ranked number 14, up from last year where we were ranked. Nevada was ranked 2017. And for the last year, number 1 spot has been held by Alaska, and Louisiana held the number 2 spot, and Mississippi held number 3 spot. And we usually see higher rates typically in STDs in the southern states along with the western states. Here we're looking at the last 5 years of trends of chlamydia rate broken down by male and female. Actually, female have higher rates than the males. However, as you can see here, like whether you're female or male, the rates have increased in the last 5 years. Next, looking at gonorrhea rate, comparing against with the national rate, Nevada again is much higher than the U.S. at 216.0 compared to the United States rate of 179.1. This puts Nevada in number 12, up from number 14 last year. Mississippi holds number 1 since last year, and Alaska is at number 2. And this year, South Carolina came in at number 3, and where last year number 3 was Louisiana. And here we're looking at rates compared to male and female for gonorrhea. And for this one, male actually has higher rate than the females. However, we can see an increase happening in both sexes. So I just kind of want to talk to you a little bit about some of our ongoing intervention efforts that are happening right now. So because of the increase that we've seen in congenital syphilis, we started doing academic detailing. And basically what that is a peer-to-peer outreach effort. It's kind of like how pharmaceutical reps go talks to doctors to try to influence them on their prescription behavior and change their prescription behavior. It's kind of like the same concept where we have a group of a team who actually goes out and talk to providers and to talk to them about the importance of prenatal care and importance of screening among pregnant women. Because currently we have a law that states that pregnant women should be tested during their first trimester and their third trimester. And so we actually, looking at the data, what we found was a lot of these women were not accessing prenatal care, but they were accessing like ER and social service providers such as WIC and food stamp programs. And so what we did is we started to include our academic detailing among our social service providers. So we started this in May, and we actually started with all the WIC clinics here in town. And so we're partnering with them so they understand what is our syphilis climate look like, and for them to talk to their clients about getting prenatal care and getting testing. We're also doing testing in correctional facilities. We are currently doing HIV, hepatitis C, and syphilis. We also do a lot of outreach testing, such as in BAR. We currently do testing, HIV testing, and entourage. And then we also do HIV and syphilis testing at the Gay and Lesbian Center. We also participate in the gonococcal isolate surveillance program, short for GISP. And basically, it allows us to monitor anti-resistant trends in the and gonorrhea bacteria in Clark County. And we submit samples, isolate samples to the regional labs and CDC to get our samples tested for anti-resistance. We also collaborate with state and community-based organizations. Various members of our department are members of different state groups and local work groups to talk about different strategies to combat STDs. We also, in our clinic here at our sexual clinic, we also participate in expedited partner therapy, which is basically allows physicians to dispense drugs, treatment to partners of their patients without actually seeing their partners. And currently, we are working with the Board of Pharmacy and the state to get our statutes changed. Because the way it's written right now is for treatment to be dispensed, we have to have a provider and a patient relationship. So we are currently working with them to get that changed so we can offer it to, so other providers can offer it. And we're also start to engaging conversations with other providers to kind of change their willingness to offer this program. We are also doing Collect to Protect right now. Currently, we're actually doing it's a Collect to Protect is basically a self-collection testing, and so it involves a self-swabbing of the pharyngeal and the rectal areas. And we are currently doing this at the Gay and Lesbian Center. But what we hope to do in the future, and what we're working on, is to make this a home testing kit where individuals can test at their own comfort of their own home and then mail it in for to us so we can test it. And then if they become positive, we have disease investigators that will connect with those patients to bring it in for treatment and for partner services. Yes.
Let's go back to that expedited partner therapy policy change of Board of Pharmacy. What is it that you're trying to get the Board of Pharmacy to do?
So we're trying to get them on board so we can get the statutes changed. So where it's written right now is that it requires a doctor to see the patient before they can prescribe medication. And so with the expedited partner therapy is basically like I would go in and see Dr. Osgood, and he would give me my medicine, my treatment, but then I have few partners that needs to be treated, but they're not going to come in. So then he would give me the medicine to deliver to my partners.
Have you already contacted the pharmacy staff, the Board of Pharmacy staff?
I'm going to let Victoria Burris, who's the manager of the program, talk about that.
Yeah, let me just tell you what I asked, because I am on the Board of Pharmacy, and this is the first I've heard of this.
Oh.
have a question. As far as the self-test,
yes.
Are you considering doing any virtual doctor's office, like an online consultation, to make it a little easier in accessibility for patients to get treatment and try to get these numbers down?
Telemedicine.
Sorry.
One question.
Telemedicine. So is there any thought process in getting any telemedicine or teledocs to people that may not want to come in, or so they could do a self-test and maybe speak with a physician, or go online and have a consultation with someone and to get some help and to get some treatment?
So currently our Collect to Protect project would allow the client who's ordering the kit online to have direct access to somebody, opportunity to ask questions in terms of access to a physician. I'm not sure if that's something clinical services would want to comment on.
Thank you. No, so far we haven't engaged in telemedicine yet. That's part of the future operation that we will have here, not just for STD, but also for other activities that we do. But right now, we don't have telemedicine here. Yeah, but it's important. It's a
good
point.
Are we considering that? I mean, I really think I just see these numbers doubling. And I don't know what the explosion has been in the last 5 years, what has really done it, but I don't know if it's antibiotic resistance or people are just afraid to go in. But I think that this way, it still leaves a little bit of a barrier. There still gives them a little bit of privacy. They may be embarrassed to do something to at least get some help.
Yeah. That's a good point. And we certainly want to look into that direction as well. Yes.
So if I could answer the question about EPT, we're working with our STD project coordinator at the state, who has been in contact, from our understanding, with the Board of Pharmacy to look at adding an exception to that patient-provider relationship rule.
Okay, and they may have been in contact with the staff, but I just wanted to hear what you had to say about it, just so I could follow up also.
Sure.
The board. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank
you very much. Yeah, sure.
And that is it for me. Any other questions?
I just wanted to make a comment about congenital syphilis, and the issue with congenital syphilis is more, I would say, indirectly a reflection of access to care. So we have all those young pregnant women who just don't go to the provider, either because they don't have insurance, or if they have insurance, they haven't been properly educated about the importance of that. I think this issue of congenital syphilis is something that we have to focus strongly, because it's something that is preventable. And we have to identify the areas of the community where we can work and make a difference, because really, having this high rate of congenital syphilis is something that shouldn't be happening today.
Just an editorial on my other life. I mentioned this before, I think. I don't know if I mentioned it to you, but I was a decade ago, I was invited to participate in by the National Underwriters, past president of the National Underwriters Association, into a forum, a national forum, to find out all the problems that are happening in the healthcare system. Did I mention this before? And we met in 2006, 7, and 8. It was, there were a few of us from Nevada, and we issued a report. We concluded that the whole healthcare delivery system is broken. And we issued a report, we called it the Healthcare Summit Report, and to our shock, the report got into Congress and into the White House and changed the dialogue, and most of our recommendations are included in the Affordable Care Act. Among them, following that in 2015, we reconvened, so to speak. I was the editor of both the original report and the follow-up report, and we've concluded that most people don't have access to health care services in this country. Financial is just one part of it, and you're seeing a ripple effect. If you're at all interested, the report is online at thehealthcaresummit.org, and I'll give you a little fun thing that happened. It got distributed to a guy by the name of John McCain, who was a senator from our neighboring state. He wrote me back because I gave it to him. And he said, you guys are right on. And 2 weeks later, he did his thumbs down theatrical thing to keep the Obamacare in place. you might find it interesting in you're describing the rollouts of not having access.
If I could just add one little piece, one thing that our program is working on, in addition to considering other strategies like telemedicine and things like that, our program manager, Marlo Tonge, is working on, with recommendations from the Department of Health and Human Services, on rapid start clinics in the community that's set in community-based organizations that have access to target populations. The first of its kind here for Clark County would be at the Gay and Lesbian Center. In this clinic, we would be able to offer services at non-traditional hours for populations that don't necessarily seek care elsewhere. So that's another strategy that we're looking at to try to, you know, increase those numbers.
Question, do you have access to the data that you've got that breaks down the affected population ethnically?
Yes.
You might want to take a look at that.
Yeah.
We have pockets, we have areas of Nevada that certain ethnic groups just don't have any access to care.
Right, blacks have the highest rate in syphilis.
Blacks
have the highest rate in syphilis, HIV as well. Gonorrhea and chlamydia, we see it in there as well.
Mm-hmm. That's some real problems. I'm sorry for editorializing. Any other comments? Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
And why don't you give us a follow-up on this now, one or two meetings from now, to see if we can make any progress whatsoever.
All right, thank you. That was a close one.
Be careful.
Take you while I'm leaving.
Oh, okay. Well, it's gone.
I guess item 6.3, are there any recommendations the board we would like to make at this time on any subject, I guess? Is that
that's correct?
This would be to the Board of Health.
Correct.
Why don't you tell everybody the follow-up that you had when you met the Board of Health on the sales.
Was that the last meeting the Board of Health, or that I, where I spoke at that Board of Health meeting? Was that,
I can't
that was in October?
Yes.
Yeah. Basically, I discussed with them what we discussed here about the people without licenses that are selling food out there and how it could harm the public. And I told them how we felt about it, that the health department, I said, the health department here needed some teeth to go out and enforce these licensees, or non-licensed people. And I said, because right now, basically, if you have a license, you should just forget about it and not get a license, because you're better off without it. If you have a license, you're being inspected and having your license taken away, you're being fined. And if you don't have a license, you're just being told, don't do that again. And I went to Commissioner, I just mentioned her name to you, on the Board of Health, Kirkpatrick.
Kirkpatrick?
Yeah, my plea was basically to her for the commission to pass some ordinance that you could hang your head on when you go out there to get these people fined and arrested and into a courtroom. She said that she would prefer to leave it up to the, licensing board, if I'm not mistaken, that they should go out and police this rather than the health board. And basically, they said they're going to follow up and go ahead with it. The only way I could follow up with it myself is a Mesquite. The city that I represent also has a city councilman on the health board. His name is Brian Worsten, and he has our packet that I gave him, all the dangers of it, and he said that he would continue to fight it with the health board since he's on the health board to make sure that they do move in that direction, and he's going to report back to me and let me know how it's going. So when I hear from Brian, I will pass it on here at the meeting to see if they are actually, in fact, doing what they promised they would do to help fight these people that are out there passing around food that they're cooking in their backyard.
Any questions? Any questions from the audience? Okay.
So there are no recommendations to the full board?
I don't think we've got any new recommendations at this point. We just, at this point, we appreciate the information we've got about the accreditation, and we'll help you in every way we can. We'll help you in every way we can with the epidemic. It isn't quite an epidemic yet, but it's close to an epidemic of STD. Go ahead.
The next item would be board reports.
Yeah. Oh, wait, you get it. What are the board reports?
Information like what Mr. Tomaso.
Anybody else have any board reports? Okay. Anybody on the phone with a board report?
Mr. Collins, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Then let's have the health officer.
Thank you. Okay, so we will talk about the influenza season. And so far in the last 8-9 weeks, there have been an increase in the number of influenza cases. The same with the hospital admission for influenza. Until week 52, we have reported 6 confirmed deaths from influenza, but this is not in this report because it just came up within last week. There were 5 additional influenza-related deaths reported last week, so that brought our grand total to 11 influenza-related deaths. And as every year, we keep the message to the community about the importance of influenza vaccination. And every year, it becomes perhaps the biggest challenge. We have seen, especially this year, an increase in the activity of anti-vaccine movement across the country, not just in Nevada. And this is something that we need to be aware of and also emphasize our education and collaborating with community organizations and the school system and other partners so we get the message across about the importance of the influenza immunization. We also, in December, we have the an event here that is called the Fast Track Nevada, and this is part of the international movement about emphasizing the importance of HIV prevention and elimination. Actually, we have representatives from the community and the main jurisdictions here. They signed the agreement for this fast track. The main targets of the fast track are to have 90% of people living with HIV/AIDS being identified. Right now, that's a big challenge because a large proportion of people who are infected with HIV, living with HIV, don't know about their HIV status. The second target is for those who have been identified as living with HIV, the next step is actually to get into care. having 90% of those who are identified as living with HIV receiving proper care or proper antiviral medications. And then the next target is to be able to achieve 90% of viral suppression among those who have been already put on antiviral medication treatment. Those are the three main goals of this campaign. And in addition to that, there is a fourth element, which is about making sure that people living with HIV are not discriminated, and the rights are respected, and they receive proper care across the country and also in international sites as well. So that event took place here in December 1st, and we have a lot of attendance for that purpose. Now, we have also a report on vaping from Mike.
Yeah. I've got a question.
Oh, yes, please.
The school immunization laws in Nevada, I assume it does not include mandatory influenza vaccine. Do you know?
Mandatory influenza vaccine?
Years ago, almost every state in the Southwest passed a law that you can't get into school unless you're immunized, from beginning in elementary school. And I'm assuming that influenza is not one of the mandatory.
That is correct. That is correct.
Still correct, right?
Yes, influenza immunization is not included among the required vaccines for a school.
Okay, that's what
yes.
Yeah. And the other question is just a global number. Do you have an estimate of how many HIV cases are identified in this county currently? Just out of ballpark?
In 2018, Clark County had 457 new HIV cases.
And we don't know what percent that is of the population that's got HIV, is what you're saying.
Well, if you look at it, the whole population, it's about half a percent.
About half a percent. It's half a percent?
You're asking about, okay.
So if we got 500 at ballpark cases of AIDS in HIV that we know about, that we may have 1,000 to 1,500 for all we know that we haven't identified. We don't have any handle on that at all.
So nationally,
can you come to the podium, please? Thank you.
So years back nationally, CDC came with a model to identify and account for undiagnosed HIV cases, and they put it about 20%. But with the state, when you put it to a state, the state level and then the local level, it's a little harder.
Right.
Something that we're planning to work on next year, just because we're part of the Fast Track Nevada, and there's a dashboard for statistics and data to go on there. So we are looking into, I think Seattle did one at the local level where they used their data to modeling and came up with the number of undiagnosed, and that's something that we're planning to work this year to see if we can kind of estimate how many undiagnosed are currently living in Clark County.
So at this point, the answer is we don't know.
We don't know.
Any other questions?
Okay. Is this on? There we go. Good morning, board members. Dr. Michael Johnson, Director of Community Health. A couple of updates this morning. I wanted to first provide you just an update on the lung injury vaping cases that we're seeing nationally in here in Clark County. As I think I've mentioned before, every Thursday it's every other Thursday now, we have conference calls with the CDC and the FDA where they provide updates on the national numbers and the analysis of a lot of the products that have been, the THC and nicotine products that have been submitted to both agencies and so on. So as of actually January 7th, there's been 2,602 hospitalized cases reported from all 50 states around the country. Of those, there's been 57 deaths in 27 states. And as I've mentioned also, vitamin E acetate, which is a thickening agent, a cutting agent that's used primarily in the THC liquid, in the cases they've evaluated with lung injury or deaths, vitamin E acetate has been found in virtually every single case. Now, there are a lot of other glycol, propylene, and a lot of other chemicals that they're finding that are also in these products, but predominantly it's been vitamin E acetate. Locally here, we've seen six cases thus far, one under the age of 18, five over the age of 18. The majority of them have vape THC, although we have one case that's vape nicotine only. Similar sort of proportions nationally with the data. The predominant number of cases have been vaping THC liquid, but there have been cases that have vaped nicotine liquid exclusively. The sources primarily we're still finding for among folks who are where they're getting these products have been friends online or retail shops. In some ways, this is kind of leveling off and winding down a bit, but there's still cases that are being reported from each state, and a lot of analysis still needs to be done. And states and local jurisdictions are waiting the analysis of a lot of the products that we've submitted, for example, and we should be receiving those in February. So at the next board meeting, can give a more detailed update on the analysis that happened here. Just related to this, because Dr. Osgood, you've mentioned and been doing a great job trying to help us to secure some money for youth vaping and for marijuana. And this recently, just very recently, we just submitted a proposal on Friday. The state is providing $100,000 to four health jurisdictions around the state. So we'll be receiving $100,000 for a short time contract through June to have one of our epi analysts look at a lot of the data, which they've already been looking at with the lung injury cases, but also other prevalence data related to vaping, marijuana, and nicotine, which will then be all these data that are gathered by the four jurisdictions will be rolled up and put into a comprehensive analysis that will be used by the state to develop a media campaign and social marketing campaign around youth marijuana and vaping. Lifting from the pages of the opioid playbook, the state is also going, as you might recall, there was an opioid summit in 2016 and a follow-up. There'll also be a summit, likely sometime later this year, on youth marijuana use and vaping. So I can stay tuned for that, as this is just kind of in the early stages of rolling out. Let's see, other tobacco stuff, but I can catch that later. secondly, I know Dr. Osgood, you'd asked for some of the data that we have that's available on teen suicide. And we are also in kind of the early stages of beginning to develop interventions and determine sort of where people are from a skill standpoint and capacity standpoint, both internally and in the community. To look at some of the data, suicide is the second leading cause of death for young people ages 15 to 24, and it's the second leading cause of death among Nevada youth age 10 to 24. We've seen over the last 5 years, from 2014 to 2018, you'd ask to look at some five-year trend data, a gradual increase in teen suicide deaths here in Clark County. When we look at the data for Clark County compared to the state of Nevada and nationally, it really mirrors the trends of these gradual increases over time over the last 5 years. the current efforts that are underway here at SNHD is, first is the zero suicide implementation, and Rebecca Cruz-Mann, Rebecca, you may want to stand up. Rebecca's leading our efforts here. She put a face with this and a name with this. And in November of 2019, we launched an internal staff capacity survey to assess how staff feel regarding their ability to provide suicide care and input through the implementation of a suicide prevention program. So we've begun to assess internal staff capacity. There's plans for an all-staff training for an evidence-based suicide alertness training called Safe Talk, which is a three-hour training that prepares helpers, regardless of their prior experience or training, to become a suicide alert helper, which will assist staff to identify persons with thoughts of suicide or suicide ideation and connect them to suicide first aid resources. We also have been having a number of meetings, monthly and quarterly, with community partners to facilitate their engagement. The community partners predominantly that we've been working with in this area, Nevada Office of Suicide Prevention, Nevada Youth Suicide Prevention Task Force, and the Child Death Review Board. We also have our epidemiologists looking at the National Violent Death Reporting System. And this system collects data on violent deaths, and it also brings together multiple sources of data in an anonymous database to sort of look at the more comprehensive picture of teen suicide. Some of the other sources of data that are included are law enforcement, death certificate data, toxicology, medical examiner coroner reports, and child fatality review, domestic violence fatality review, and crime lab data. So we're triangulating lots of sources of data to take to get as clear a picture as we can. So next steps really are to implement the internal policies for suicide prevention training here at SNHD, to increase the collaboration efforts with our community partners, and to implement efforts to train staff in the community youth mental health first aid that I mentioned. This is in the early stages, so as this rolls out, either myself or Rebecca likely will be able to provide more detailed updates on how we're doing here and what our numbers look like, but obviously another very important issue for us to address as we build our behavioral health capacity here at SNHD as well. So that's kind of the quick snapshot on teen suicide. I hope that was responsive, Dr. Osborne.
Yeah, you're making a start.
Okay, good.
We've got a lot of public health issues, don't we?
Yes, we do. We certainly do. Yeah, we do. All right, I think other than that, we're good. Any questions?
Do you have any questions?
Out of curiosity, Doctor, I bet over the years you read about statistics from states that legalize marijuana, and they talk, the statistics that they quote are where marijuana is a contributing factor to an uptick in suicides, homicides, violent crime, automobile accidents, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I understand that those statistics are only as good as the organizations like the law enforcement, if they'll give you the statistics, or the medical profession, or the doctors, or the hospitals. I mean, they would have to give them to you, otherwise you can't keep them.
Right.
But I'm wondering, does our health department attempt to obtain any of these statistics at all, or are we not following it or tracking it, or how does Nevada stand since we've legalized marijuana? Are we keeping anything at all?
Well, I mean, we do gather data from a variety of multiple data sources, I mentioned, even as it relates to this. So we can look at those data here in Nevada, but again, we're in the very early stages, so we haven't done any of those kinds of analyses yet. We will be looking at that. This $100,000 grant that I mentioned that we'll be receiving is to really have our epi and analysts look at the a comprehensive picture of youth vaping and marijuana use here in Southern Nevada. So as much of a comprehensive picture as we can give around, you know, what that looks like, what it looks like with respect to morbidity and mortality, we'll do that, so.
But if there's no requirement for these organizations, whether it's the medical field or the law enforcement, there's no requirement for them to keep these statistics or give you these statistics. It's the coroner, for example. If he's not going to give them to you, we're not going to have them. Am I right about that?
Well, right. And fortunately, we have the coroner, for example, we have developed a very good relationship with the coroner's office here. We work with them on a variety of issues. So big kudos to all my staff who have worked over the years to develop these relationships with not just the coroner, but a lot of the other community partners that we work with. However, you know, even despite the good relationships, you know, we look at the data very carefully for its validity and reliability. And oftentimes, when we launch projects like this, we find that there's a plethora of very useful data, and then there are a lot of gaps. And sometimes that, you know, leads us in a direction of primary data collection. So again, early stages, but as we find out where some of the data might be weak or there's gaps in data, we can look to see what we can do to try to fill those gaps.
But there's no requirement for anybody to give you anything, basically.
Right, right.
Thank you. It's persuasion.
Persuasion, right, and relationships.
Right. So. As part of your background, you people might, if you haven't, you might want to read a bestseller book right now called The Coddling of the American Mind. Hmm. It is an effort to, it's now the New York number one bestseller, one of the bestsellers on the New York Times list. And it's about the internet generation, the social media issues that it's creating, and it goes through, I suggest that it would be helpful to have as background material. It describes how this is the generation, I don't know if all of you know, but they've been measuring suicide since the 1890s, and this generation has the highest suicide rate of any generations in over 100 years. And there's some information in there you might find interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
It's called The Coddling of the American Mind.
Coddling of the American Mind. We'll check it out. Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have also a report about the illegal vending machine, illegal vending.
Trading and vending.
Any the public comments?
Hello, Chris Saxton, Director of Environmental Health. So with the illegal vending program, kind of as we've discussed before, it's a funding issue. And so we're going to Board of Health. We want to bring back basically two inspectors dedicated to illegal vending. And with that, we need the fees. And one thing we're trying to work with the Board of Health is they want us to do a fee study over a year to see which programs should increase fees and then come back to the fee committee and basically have them make a recommendation. Now, I know Marilyn made the recommendation we come back in 6 months instead of a year to try to do this a little quicker and to see where we can come from. So right now, you know, we have our regular inspection staff. They have their own mandates to meet. We have to prioritize those at the time being. But we still go out there and try to do those illegal vending inspections when they come up. We try to focus on the areas where we get, you know, a lot. We see a lot of activity. We basically got Google Maps. We try to pinpoint those areas of where those illegal vendors are so that we can also make the rounds while the inspector's out. But really, until we get more resources, that's kind of where we're stuck at the moment.
Do you need our support to push for more money?
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Do you need our support to push for more money?
Oh, I think, yeah, all the support we can get would be greatly appreciated.
So, should we ask that we ask the board to act as prompt as they can to increase the funding to get you the staff you need to be able to implement the program once you know? Is that the wrong way to say it? Hearing no response.
Yeah, it sounds good to me.
I still don't understand with increased staff how that's going to help you get these people into a courtroom. I don't understand. What Merlin Kirkpatrick's point was that
it's not up to the health board, it's up to, am I right about, wrong about that, the licensing board or something? What did you say at that meeting?
Yeah, we don't have the ability to write general ordinance summons to take anybody to court. So that's also another side of it, which is something we'd have to work with Board of Health, is what as an enforcement we can do. Right now, you know, we can take the food when we find them. Part of that is we also have to work with other community partners, say code enforcement for some of the cities, but you know, we do all Clark County, there's a bunch of different jurisdictions, trying to get everybody together can be a problem, but they're the ones that can actually write the general order and summons, have that. So that's another aspect to illegal vending that is a problem. One of it is we just don't have enough staff here to go out and look at the problem all over Clark County. And the other part is, yeah, what do you do enforcement wise? And all those are kind of things we're trying to look at. How can we get, you know, what they call the CMART activities, trying to get the other jurisdictions and all of us going out there together with the police. And some of the big ones, like Sandy Sue, is one where we have a lot of problems where we're able to get the police and code enforcement to go out there. But, you know, sometimes there's hiccups because we're not all one jurisdiction. I've worked for other jurisdictions where, you know, you're a city entity and you just get the city manager to come on board and he tells everybody to do it. And the health district's not that way. We're our own thing. Each jurisdiction's got their own, and we have to try to work together as best we can. And, you know, everybody has got their own budget issues.
Yeah, I understand it. But there still is no ordinance that gives you any enforcement. All you can do is take the food or tell them to move on, basically. And I was trying to get to the point to the board that that's not enough. That's not going to stop anything. In fact, it's going to turn people with licenses to give up their licenses, because why should they get inspected, get fined, and have their license taken away from them for selling food? They're in compliance. When the people are out of compliance, nothing's happening to them. I mean, we could talk forever about it, but I understand your predicament. You still need staff. You still need staff, but you need something else to go with that.
Yeah. So, of course, the staff issue is the one we're working on right now.
I see.
But who currently is able to actually cite the people that are illegally vendors out there? I mean, I know your department could go down there, take the food, say, please don't do this again, but there's no recourse to prevent them from doing it again.
Yeah, so really when we go out there, it's that jurisdiction, whether it's that city's code enforcement or the other entities out there that have that power to issue the general ordinance summons to take them to court. We don't have that.
Right.
So all our ordinance gives us the ability to do is to confiscate the food.
So having additional labor or additional inspectors that can go out there, you'd be able to take food or shut down momentarily however many vendors it is, but still it would be the same predicament unless it progressed into a situation where you had the ability to do something more substantial.
Sure, and when we have more inspectors, say this, we get these two inspectors, they're devoted to illegal vending, then this is their job. They can more go to those other jurisdictions, you know, and try to get that help, because they're not our other inspectors just trying to get their regular inspections done and doing this when they can. This is now going to be something where they can try to get this going as best we can with other jurisdictions until such a time that either we have our own ordinance that does something or we figure out a better way to do it. It's, you know, this isn't an issue just for, you know, Clark County. This is an issue all over. It's a difficult one.
So maybe having a small group of new inspectors that are focusing specifically on this issue, it would be beneficial.
Yeah,
where they can work relationships with the entities that can enforce the codes.
And we actually had this in the past here before funding kind of diverted these inspectors other ways, where, you know, they had that close relationship with other jurisdictions and we could do more than we could now, just because that was their primary focus of their job was illegal vending.
Well, that would be a recommendation that might be interesting to have.
So why don't we make your recommendation a motion that we, I don't know exactly the right way to say that.
So we're going to go back to item 6.3, discuss and approve recommendations of the District Board of Health. Is that what you're proposing?
Yeah, and the recommendation being that we endorse your request of the board to get funding to increase your staff.
Yes, and the new staff to be focused on this particular aspect of the community concern.
Would that recommendation also include a encouragement of the local jurisdictions to work more closely with the health district in terms of code enforcement?
Sure, yes.
And yeah, just to clarify, we are going to try to get fees raised for all our programs, but that's part of that package is those two people just specifically for legal vending.
So all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Mr. Collins, are you still there?
I'm here.
Unanimous. All opposed? No.
Thank you.
And that concludes our report.
That concludes your report?
Yeah.
Any questions of the chief health officer? Okay, any public comments? Hearing none, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.